cross-section of this model through the body, the relationship of the windlace,
which is
the area your head has to pass in order to get into the car.
W-I-N-D-L-A-C-E.
Yeah, wind, W-I-N-D, and lace is that strip. Mm-hmm. They don't usually use them. Some cars still have them. Mm-hmm. But they used to have, they'd have a seal, and they'd have a wind lace, and some cars still have, mm-hmm. have that extra right. piece. But anyway, the piece that your head has to pass relative to the A point, and that's the point that they use on the seat for positioning the Oscar.
The
in other words, yeah, it's the seat, it's the point you're setting on.
Okay.
In effect.
A point. Mm-hmm.
So this relationship, this was what was current on the 52 Ford mm-hmm. Mercury Lincoln, and this was what I had. However, that doesn't give you the true relationship. The true relationship relative one to another is this.
Mm-hmm.
The A point moved from here down to here. The opening moved from here to here. And that's what this model represented.
The difference between the current model and your
yes.
and your conception.
You know, inches, like a foot difference.
Yes.
Now, as far as space, usable space, the relationship is somewhat different. In other words, it was designed as a two-seater rather than a three-seater seat. So,
the rear seat.
Well, the front seat also.
Oh, front seat also.
So it that is a little bit different. However, you could have a seat to set three people in if you'd so wish, but this wasn't designed for that. It was designed as a coupe. But nevertheless, you can see the relationship there. Oh, I'm sorry. It does have the same point.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the wrong point here. But you bring this back up, and that's
the overlay that you have.
Yeah, that's where the real relationship of wheels were, and the real opening dropping this far, and the seat dropping that far.
So you were in the vanguard at that point for long, low, underslung.
Well, you know, they were so slow in coming out with these things. This was a section I had used for this,
mm-hmm.
and with flush. You know, flush glass, flush drip, flush
right.
roof, all in one line.
I think looking back on it, only Howard Darin was able to come out with something like that, and that was a limited edition for Kaiser.
Yeah.
Would you say that was a...
It was very low.
Very low.
Yes. There were a few specials, yes, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Hudson made a strive into that.
Mm-hmm.
But
Ford wasn't buying it at that point.
Well, they needed to go down the road a bit further, but you know, they didn't work on it.
Didn't they really?
Mm-mm. Not at that time.
Your full size play was as far as it got, huh?
Well, that was a 3/8.
Well, that was a 3/8.
Yeah.
So.
But sections of the floor and reinforcements for the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Which again was above, was inside, so you had a smooth underbody,
mm-hmm.
and this is what they're trying to do now, you know, for aerodynamics.
Mm.
It had a closed column, a tubular column, in effect, down the backbone through which the drive shaft would run,
mm-hmm.
and the exhaust pipes would run to the side of that exhaust. The section of the rocker would look something like that.
Curved again.
But, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this above the actual floor
mm-hmm.
as they do it, but it's a smooth line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those were the things that I did back
in 54, you were 20, 30 years ahead. Mm, at least. Must be very frustrating for you that they were
acting on you. Well, I got in Germany and I had the opportunity and I used it.
Good. Yeah.
I made a lot of advance section drawings for engineering and they followed them.
Good.
where are
well,
we?
What sort of reception did you get internally for this particular model?
Okay, well, I think it was fairly good, except that at that point in time, the spring of 1954, I guess it was, they had another reorganization, and I'm trying to remember what that one was. They set up, separate studio chiefs, and they reduced or eliminated, I think they eliminated Advanced Design as an operation.
Uh-huh.
I believe so. I'm not positive, but I think that's what happened at that time.
That Tremulous out in the...
He went out someplace, either into a very small group. So what they were basically doing, all the new hires, design fellows that would come in from art school, mm-hmm. would go into Advanced Design and spend 6 months to a year.
Sort of intern training session.
Right, and then they would go to a studio. And I think they eliminated that. They may have left, in fact, I think maybe they, I know they left a small group, but I don't think they did the whole thing as they had previously. So anyway, they had to find a place for me, and at that time they established an advanced project studio. And in that studio, they put Wes Dahlberg, and also the other designer that had been in Advanced Design, the fellow that had worked on the New York World's Fair. You said
Gil Spear.
Gil Spear.
Mm-hmm.
And they divided the work up, and so I was one of the head modelers. They had two. And so we did a variety of projects, and we did some of these English projects, which I had shown you photographs of.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the other major reorganization. That didn't last too long. I don't know, a year, maybe 2 years at the most. So that would have brought us up to 55, 56. And George Walker came in as vice president. I'm not sure of that date.
About 56.
About 56, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was another major reorganization. And what they did, design at that time, or styling as they called it, came under engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And Walker came in as a new vice president, strictly over styling.
Mm-hmm.
And engineering wanted to keep their hand in, so they wanted this special project studio. So Gil Spear and some of the people, those who wished to go, those he asked who wished to go, went with him over to their scientific lab.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up a studio there, and let's say took half the people out of that particular studio that we were in,
mm-hmm.
including Gil Spear. So he set up his operation there and ran that for, you know, a good many years. I think maybe he retired there, I'm not real sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether he came back, I don't remember. Anyway, so the other half of the studio, Wes Dahlberg, they made into Tractor and International.
Mm-hmm.
So they put us into a smaller studio, one bay, and we did the various alterations on the Canadian cars.
Mm-hmm.
And we also got involved in some of the developments on the European cars. And we also did tractors.
Mm-hmm.
And these were rather minor things, really, but there were times when we got quite busy. And at that particular time, they, and prior to that, they had administrators, and administrator in each studio.
Mm-hmm.
And the larger studios, of course, the administrator had help. Well, Art Morrell, by the way, do you have his address or phone number?
Yes, mm-hmm, I do.
Okay, I want to get that from you. Anyway, Art Morrill was our administrator. And there were times when it was too much for him. There was times when he had the right amount of work. Mm-hmm. So he asked me if I would help him. So, of course, I had done this planning and scheduling work out at Willow Run mm-hmm. for 3 years. So I learned from him how to set up and establish headcount, budget headcount. So I did this, and then each month we would do a review to determine how we stood for the relative to the budget. And so I did this for him for, I don't know, I suppose a year longer. And during this time we went through various organizational shakeups and shakeouts. And one of them being that we were transferred under Bob McGuire. In other words, Dahlberg came under Bob McGuire mm-hmm. and under Walker. And
what sort of entity was this?
Well,
was the Ford Studio?
No, this was a studio called International and Tractor.
Oh, still International and Tractor, yeah. Yes, I beg your pardon.
Yes.
And it came under Bob McGuire.
Yeah, they had a they had another administrator in there when Walker first took over, and I was trying to remember his name. And then eventually it came under McGuire. I was trying to think of that administrator's name. It wasn't Waterhouse. It was somebody after Waterhouse left. But anyway, then that went away, and they gave the control back to the design heads. So Bordenay and, well, Bordenay sort of sneaked through the organization when Walker came on board. He was very scared of his job.
Yes.
He didn't know whether he was going to last. Mm-hmm. But he did last, but Schmidt left.
Bill Schmidt, uh-huh.
Left at that
and
time.
And the shakeout.
Yes. Of course, McGuire stayed, and De La Rosa stayed, and Aros and Engel stayed because they were Walker's right hand and the left hand. So that was the organization at that time. Now,
I was going to ask you at this point, perhaps it's a good time to do it. Charlie Stobar told me about the fabrication shop. Can you describe your view of that?
Yeah, when Charlie first came over from GM back in, it would have been, I guess, fall of 48, mm-hmm. sometime 48, fall of 47, early 48 maybe. He took over all of modeling and all of shops.
Mm-hmm.
And
this would be the plaster and
plaster. They really hadn't got into plastic at that time. It was
right.
Plaster, wood, and metal.
Right.
And Leonard came over.
This is his brother, Leonard.
His brother. Mm-hmm. And they put him as one of the modeling supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie was good. He had a sensitivity for design and line and form. And of course, he was good at sculpturing. And they had their own shop, you know. And
oh, you mean on the outside?
On the outside.
And
he would work there at night doing things. I remember, it was a very good answer he gave me. One night he was going out with his little tools,
uh-huh.
you know, like these in his hand. And I was kidding him something about his tools. And he said, "These are my real tools." He's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His hands
mm-hmm.
were the real tools. But anyway, that organization went on for some time, and eventually, well, when Walker took over, they set up, I guess they call it chief designer, and these heads, previous heads, the ones that were still there, became chief designer of over the various studios. And I believe Bob McGuire had Interior and International Tractor, whatever it was called. Mm-hmm. And they set up at that time Charlie Stobar as, and I don't know whether they called him chief or they may have called him director or something, of fabrication. Mm-hmm. And I think at that time he was out of modeling. He just had fabrication.
Right.
But they left Leonard as one of the supervisors of modeling. Mm-hmm. And
how was Leonard?
Well, Leonard,
brother.
Leonard didn't have the sensitivity that Charlie had as far as design is concerned. He was a fair modeler, but he didn't have the patience to work out a model. And you know, Charlie protected him.
He then got into fabrication, didn't he?
No, he never,
never
got
did. Mm-hmm. Oh.
But his problem, which was a major problem, of course, was that he had a drinking problem. Mm-hmm. And so this was always something that hung over his head. Mm-hmm. And
his brother described him as easygoing.
He was easygoing, that was for sure. Everybody liked Leonard, mm-hmm, because he was easygoing, you know?
And a bit lazy.
Yeah, here's Advanced Design, and I think I talked about it at one of the periods of time. That was under... that's Larry Wilson, there in the middle.
Oh, uh-huh. I asked this of Charlie Stobar. Did you have, this advertisement reminds me, did you have a problem like the one that exploded on General Motors in terms of effluent and ventilation and air conditioning and masks and protective goggles? Did you have all, was all that environment taken care of at Ford?
What do you say?
Well, he said, no. He said, we didn't have that kind of a problem. We had adequate ventilation. We had, but he said, many of us old timers, we didn't pay much attention to it. We'd grown up in an era when there wasn't those conveniences. And,
you know, the difference being is that they didn't have plastics at that time.
That's right. Plastics are the real problem.
Yes.
The dust. And,
of course, when we moved from the engineering lab over to the new design styling building, mm-hmm, they had a nice shop area. They had ventilation. Mm-hmm. And plaster shop had their own area. And, of course, as it became necessary, they put in other ventilation. Mm-hmm. And it was quite adequate there.
We
got
it?
A nice shop area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Never had the problem. Paint was more of a problem.
Uh-huh.
Paint used to be the problem back in the old days.
Was it?
Mm-hmm. In fact, it's every Almost place toxic. I've ever been, you know, it's a problem.
Almost toxic, then.
Well, the trouble is, some things wait until last, and they've got to come into the studio and paint.
Mm.
And then everybody hollers, you know.
Yes.
And, yes, they had to have certain precautions in the paint booths, which they didn't have in the studio when they did it. We did a few models, English models, and this was the photograph, you know, I had shown you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When we were still under Waterhouse, a large organization. But, this was that tractor model I told you about. We did in the Tractor International Studio.
Can you describe that?
Well, it was, this photograph was in the Ford Rouge News back in August 21, 1959, and of course at that time we were in Germany, but this model had been completed about 2 years before that. And tractor division, it was in a down period, and Walker had his own budget, and so they decided to do, each studio would do at least one advanced design, or one or two. So they did a series of advanced designs, first scale models and then some full-size models. And we did this tractor. And the tractor is unusual back at that time in that it's four-wheel drive, and I guess maybe just the front wheels steered. But these were the large driving wheels on all four corners. Mm-hmm. It had an enclosed cab up front. The engine was like a mid-engine. And the cab had a lot of glass or plastic, so the farmer could see all around.
The first of the modern
tractors, really. Because mm-hmm. I hadn't seen anything like this anyplace else. And they give the artists chance to go all out. So it's a very, has a lot of form, yet it's still a functional design.
Was it adopted? Is that a production?
No, not really. It was merely a design theme or
any
exercise.
Any salient features adopted in the next 5 years?
Well, the idea of four-wheel drive, certainly, and
yes.
The idea of a closed cab.
Yes.
So they all have a closed cab now. I don't think any of the tractors have come out with a front seating. Of course, you could say it's the other way around. You could say that this is the
yes.
front end, you know,
mm-hmm.
except that they've got their hitch here.
Mm-hmm.
So the pool size that we did in that studio, well, this was the other scale model we did. And then we did sort of a blow up from that, which was this. It's somewhat more conservative, but it had, on the one side, it had the angled taillight, which Mercury picked up a few late years later. The taillights that, in the,
mm-hmm.
I guess,
the
Comet,
Did you say?
Canted.
Yeah, right, mm-hmm, yes.
I never liked it, but they picked that part up. It had a fastback.
Yes.
The other side was a conventional, more conventional backlight.
What model is this again?
Well, it was just an advanced design. It was called the Debonair.
The Debonair, yes.
And however, the so-called P3 Taunus took some of its theme from this.
Did it?
There is some, you can see some carryover. So when we went to Germany,
we took
this somewhat along, and you can see this had a fin,
mm-hmm.
and the taillight in the fin. Well, they didn't like the fin over there. So basically, while Dahlberg was working on the front, I trimmed the fin off. We have just a little rise all the way through,
mm-hmm.
and of course made this more of an oval like this.
On the rear quarter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and soften this area a little.
What's that?
A little more.
Tumble home.
Yeah, the shape of the window and the shape of the backlight is it doesn't have mm-hmm. the appearance of height.
Mm-hmm.
I think we may have raised this a little, and we soften this at front. This always had to look like it was going uphill. You know, the front of the window.
Mm-hmm.
It looks higher here than it is here. I don't know whether it is or not. So this was softened some, and the front end I believe was more dramatic on the Taunus, but this picked up a little of the theme.
Good.
So that was completed.
And that was the?
It was just an exercise. And about that time, then, they reorganized the international groups, and
it was about 59.
Well, 50, the end of 57 and the first part of 58. And
They reorganized the international styling groups? Or the whole international structure?
The whole international structure.
I think so.
Henry Ford II felt that Europe should design their own cars. Mm-hmm. And he hired John Andrews to head up Ford of Germany. Mm-hmm. Of course, Ford of England had, his name, Sir...
Patrick
Hennessy.
Hennessy, yeah.
And they had, what's his name, Collins, as their head designer.
Colin McNeil?
Colin
Neal.
Colin Neal.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was a pretty good designer, really. And he kept things pretty much under control. Germany had a designer who was a German, didn't speak any English. They also had a fellow that was Egyptian, and I'd have to think about a while about his name. And he came over a couple of times on some of the studies that were being done. Mm-hmm. And I think he was over the last time when Henry Ford II decided he wanted the work done in Europe, and he went back, and subsequently Dahlberg went to Europe, and he talked about my going. And we had a, shortly after we had moved in here, we had this house built in 57.
We moved on Fairway in Dearborn?
Right, on Fairway in Dearborn. And then we moved in here, I think, like in October of 57. And in March, we had sort of a housewarming for everybody in design, plus the fact that Dahlberg was going to Europe, so it was sort of a going away party. And I knew at that time that I was probably going to Europe too, but it was a housewarming and a going away party for Dahlberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I was transferred under Leonard Stobar over in Ford's studio. So the last thing that I worked on in before leaving was this Ford, I had it here a little bit ago. The Ford Falcon was the last thing I worked on just before going to Europe.
Mm-hmm. That was McNamara's enthusiasm, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was. And that was with Joe Oros. So anyway, Walker met me in the hall when Dahlberg had been asked, and so they were talking to me about it. And
Dahlberg wanted you to go.
Dahlberg wanted me to go, and I got this letter from, well, John Andrews' letter to Tom Lilly.
Lilly was the Ford of Europe.
Yeah, he was the vice president Ford of Europe at that time.
To read it.
Well, general manager, vice president and general manager, Ford International Division, says, "Dear Tom, an analysis of the personnel problems in the Cologne styling office reveals a definite need for an experienced clay modeler who is capable of directing and instructing an inexperienced staff in the creation of 3/8 scale and full scale models, including all faces from basic body forms to fine detail work. He must understand the essentials of planning and timing, of budget requirements, and the technicalities of ordering and setting up of necessary equipment. A specialist of this type is urgently needed to 1) assume responsibility for the three-dimensional phase of the critical NPX program, which will extend over a period of many months, 2) supervise the completion of the accelerating 17M facelift program, 3) direct the training of our modeling group in its development as part of a self-operating, efficient styling organization, and 4) supervise the setting up of modeling and fabrication facilities in a new styling building. Since all of the full-size work has previously been done in plaster and metal only, there are consequently no seasoned clay modelers. The training of these people must develop over a period of many varied programs under the close supervision of a leader who is thoroughly familiar with tested practices of our Dearborn Styling Center." Mr. Dahlberg had previously discussed the possibilities of such a need with both Mr. George Walker and Mr. George Johnson of the styling office. In this connection, he proposed the name of Mr. Fred Hoadley, a master modeler, who for several years has been associated with the International Styling Studio. The assignment should preferably be for a 3-year period in order to achieve optimum effectiveness in a limited time for the Cologne group. Should Mr. Hoadley not be available, perhaps styling office can supply Mr. Dahlberg with names of other possibilities. The transfer should become effective as soon as possible. Due to our critical timing situation, it is most expedient that we act on this matter quickly. Would you contact Mr. Walker to see that action can be taken? Sincerely, J.S. Andrews.
And that was dated?
April 11, 1958.
When did you leave?
I left a month later, I think like May 9th or 10th.
Stop right there. I think that's just the perfect place to stop.
Okay.
Mr. Hoadley, perhaps today we could begin the saga of your 9-year sojourn in Ford of Germany in Cologne as the head of their modeling program. Now let's see.
Well, we were given, following this receipt of this memo from Andrews, and through George Walker, we were given this more or less opportunity ultimatum. George said, "Well, there's really nothing I can do for you here right now, and this is a good chance for you." Well, of course, I had known that I was going to be asked for, and the difficulties at the time were that we had just built this house and had just moved in a few months before. But again, what happened in Design Center at the time was that the studio that we were in, which had been international and Tractor, the Tractor was sort of a small entity, but we were doing the various Canadian cars and the European models as they came along, was in effect disbanded. Because they pulled out the European cars, they were going to do them overseas. The Canadian was a small task. It was ornamentation, basically grills and exterior ornamentation and interior ornamentation, designating a monarch and Richelieu. No, Richelieu was a monarch, a type of monarch, a meteor.
Meteor.
They had a meteor and a monarch. So this was given, I guess, to the Ford studio and the Mercury studio, the particular vehicles that they came from. And so the studio was disbanded, and I was, temporarily at least, transferred into studio, into Ford studio. And
who was heading that up then, do you remember?
It was Joe Orris.
Joe Orris.
And Leonard Stobar was manager of modeling. And I went in as a master modeler under Leonard Stobar. And I was in charge of some various things there. I remember the last thing I worked on was the Ford Falcon, the Ford Falcon.
Mm. What year was this again?
Well, this would have been 58. 58,
uh-huh.
And sort of worked with Orris on that, developing the theme. The theme was pretty well set when I left, I remember.
This was one of McNamara's last and the most cherished products, wasn't it? Projects,
I suppose. It was one of the more successful, certainly.
Yeah.
I would say, especially from an engineering point of view, the design, the styling of it was, I think it fit the situation at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Compact car, However, the engineering was somewhat new. It was a unit construction. They lunched off of that. I guess they're still lunching off of it because the eventually the Mustang came off of it. Eventually the well, no, I guess it's no longer used, but it was used on a lot of different cars. The basic structure, floor pan, suspension members, a lot of things.
Is that was known as the platform?
The platform.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well, anyway, so, okay, we said yes, all right, we'll go. So we had some interviews with international people over in the glass house, and they told us what it would amount to and what we would have to face as a family and
right.
all.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Did it seem daunting to you all at the time?
Well, yeah, it was, you know, it's a big step.
Yeah.
You're not real sure. We had our family, the youngest, Tim, at that time was 4. And I thought, well, you know, how will he take to it?
Right.
So, one of the things I did was I took Tim and both my wife and I were from Findlay, so I took Tim down for a couple of days, went down, maybe we came back the next day, and then we stayed down there at least overnight, and told my folks about it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'd
right.
probably written them a letter, but we went down. I thought, well, I'll take Tim along and see how little kid gets along.
Mm-hmm.
Since all of our exploits and adventures, and I think this is evident in the frontiers, the movement of people here in the United States. It's not that you move. What's important is the family nucleus.
Mm-hmm, right.
As long as the family is together, the little ones don't really care whether they're here or someplace else. As long
right.
as
sure.
mom and dad and
sure.
sister, big sister and brother are there, or whatever. So this is sort of what I came to the conclusion at that time. You know, he didn't have any trouble. He went down without his mother and with me and sort of spur of the moment, and he didn't have any trouble. So. So they lined us up to take Berlitz, German, Deutsch.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So we went down, I guess, at least twice a week. And we were taking Berlitz lessons to at least get a sufficient knowledge of the language that we could go out
yeah.
and eat, you know, and buy what we
right.
needed.
Right.
And it was certainly very helpful. So I took this, I guess, for a period of maybe 3 weeks, something like that. And they packed up my things at work. I had them ship my tabouret over,
mm-hmm.
and which I had sort of special drawers made for. So it was, everybody had their own tabourets, you know, sort of specially outfitted.
Sure.
And my toolbox. And the toolbox, they made a vinyl carrier for it, so I carried it with me as my own luggage.
Great.
And at that time, we were talking about this the other day, maybe last night.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Ford had an office in New York that handled transit people. Ford people going from here to Europe and vice versa. And Ford people
office.
Going, Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure that it came under, I suppose it must have come under international.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a special office.
Mm-hmm.
And people going to New York for business trips, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the train to New York and I guess stayed overnight there. I guess maybe I left that day because I was anxious to get over. And I flew, I think it was on a DC-9, and it had been outfitted with as a sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how long it took. It took quite a few hours, you know, at that time. It stopped, I believe, in Greenland, and then left from there and landed again in Ireland, and then landed in Holm Bonn Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so I arrived in Cologne in the morning. Of course, I was fresh, but I had slept, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And I was met by a fellow, a designer that had worked at Ford of Germany, and I think I maybe mentioned him before. His name was, he was an Egyptian designer, which is rather odd. But he had gone to school here in the United States, and I don't remember for sure where he went to school. And so Andy Raghib met me.
You spell that?
R-A-G-H-I-B, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sort of a good guy, and he never really had the right opportunities.
Mm.
So anyway, he fixed me up in they had a hotel for me, so we checked in, and it was quite a ways from downtown. So anyway, I stayed there, I think, one night, and the following day, he got me in the hotel that was right downtown Cologne. But so gathered my things up, my tools, and went out to the plant. Well, the plant, of course, in 58, things were still rather down in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were just pulling themselves up out of the bomb holes that were still there, you know. Still a lot of, they had cleaned things up. The streets were neat and orderly, you know, but there were a lot of bomb
outbuildings,
craters, and trash here and there, and bent steel, and all of this around. And Ford had, I suppose that they had avoided bombing the Ford plant. It had a few scars, but it survived without any great problem. And they had a small group of people in what they call their design group of about 15, including two secretaries. They had a fellow who was head of design, whose name was Kersting. K-E-R-S-T-R I-N-G, I think.
Kersting.
Kersting. The second R, Kersting. There's no second R.
Oh.
K-E-R-S-T-I-N-G.
Oh.
Kersting. And he was sort of typical German designer, which means he's an engineer. And he's not a stylist. He works from a theoretical base. He doesn't speak any English.
Mm.
And therefore, when we did projects here in the States, he had been over at least once or twice. But he had sent Andy Raghab because Andy was quite capable of either German or English.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy was a very aggressive sort of fellow. And so course, Wes Dahlberg was sent over there to head the operation, so this became a problem because then you've got two heads. And Kirsting was there, and so he had his secretary, so they got a secretary for Dahlberg.
Oh.
And then Kirsting, and I can't remember for sure his first name, he had a brother who was in charge of all of the technical end of it, the fabrication and modeling. They did a little bit of modeling, you know, mm-hmm. clay modeling, and right. they built up all the various necessary ornamentation and whatever final design problems would arise, they would handle over there. So they would do these sorts of things.
I wonder if I can interrupt you here for a moment and ask you if it would be instructive to trace the art of automobile modeling on the continent. Where did it actually begin?
Well, modeling as such, of course, grew out of the coach design business,
mm-hmm.
and as such still utilizes some of those these terms and methods.
Mm-hmm.
The use of clay, I think clay and wax had been used particularly for ornamentation, and let's say for things like the radiator cover, which
right.
was the big design character of any of the vehicles back in, well, particularly teens and 20s and 30s.
Right.
And so clay did get a use in those sorts of things. But normally they would use plaster.
Plaster was their major medium.
Right, and they had two ways of doing those. They would do a complete layout and build up a model based on the layout.
Mm.
And they would build up a model out of male templates. In other words, they would set up templates like in what you would call a cube,
mm-hmm.
and form a what they call now the wireframe in the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, except they were solid templates.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would fill in with plaster to this surface. And so the templates, if they were made correctly, and I'm sure that in Europe they make these things very precise,
uh-huh.
they would end up with a precise model of the layout.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, if they wanted to make any changes, why, then they would cut away the plaster and grind away or file away the template and make their whatever change they might want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other way is they would make female templates and make a plaster, make a frame to put plaster on and build it up. But so the plaster model was really basically the European way of building models and wood.
The use of clay obviously did not originate in this country. It was probably used in Europe.
Styling clay, yes, started, it was used as a sculpting medium.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, of course, it was adapted
yeah.
to other things. But they also, the Italians had developed a system and still use it. They use it, have been using it, I presume still use it, down in, at Gia.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a system where they use a material called applewood.
Hmm.
Which is something, it's like a plastic or like a plastic wood.
Uh-huh.
And they will have some sort of an armature that they will butter up with this stuff and set templates into it. Something like clay, except the material is hard.
Hmm.
But here again, they can build up a finished model with applewood and without going through a negative and positive cast.
Right.
Well, what has evolved in that, which is interesting, and this is what Gia uses now, they'll build the model out of styrofoam, which is easy to cut and trim,
mm-hmm.
and build it to the shape that they're looking for, and if
they don't like the shape while they're working on it, they'll cut a piece out and bond in a new piece and work until they've got what they want in foam. Mm-hmm. And of course, styrofoam, you can take a hot wire, electric wire, and cut it.
Uh-huh.
So they'll, after this form is finished, they'll take a wire cutter, like, well, maybe 2 centimeters, 3/4 of an inch wide, and maybe maybe 1 centimeter deep.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll cut a slot down through the foam.
Mm.
In other words, it's just like taking taking this. I guess the way I had it was better. Taking this paper clip. Now this is only 5 millimeters by wide and 1 centimeter deep.
Mm-hmm.
But if this were heated by electricity, you could take that and you could run it right down through styrofoam and it would cut a groove just like that.
Uh-huh.
So it was wider. It would be like 3/4 of an inch or 2 centimeters wide and 1 centimeter deep. It would cut a channel mm-hmm. right into the foam. And they would cut a series of these, I don't know, let's say 10 centimeters or 12 centimeters apart at places where it would give them the best surface recognition of mm-hmm. surface and surface changes.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had those grooves cut, they take this apple wood and fill the groove. And when that sets up, they'll cut out areas between
mm-hmm.
and fill that from the hard areas that are already set up in the apple wood.
Mm-hmm.
So they go from foam to apple wood,
which is
a hard plastic.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up with a hard model that's 1 centimeter thick, that is the form of the styrofoam that they had previously.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very ingenious way of doing it to achieve a hard model. They still have the styrofoam underneath, which gives it support. And they finish those up, they sand them and prime them and paint them up, and they ship them over here with a chassis, and looks great. It really looks great.
It reminds me, I was at General Motors yesterday, and this being late February of 86, and I noticed in the advanced studio that they were using a beginning mock-up of a advanced concept model they were putting together. They were using blocks of styrofoam.
Well, yeah.
And building it up, and then they were shaping. They had, as you say, a big cube, and then they would shape and the front end and the rear end
yes.
by shaving off the foam.
Well, this is the same system.
Yeah.
Except that then they revert it over to this applewood at Gia.
Now, what is the composition of applewood? Do you know anything?
Well, it's a plastic material,
mm-hmm.
and like I say,
it's malleable as long as it doesn't dry. Right?
Yes,
uh-huh.
I'm not sure what the it's composed of.
Mm-hmm.
It's apparently something that doesn't attack the styrofoam. This is mm-hmm. a problem.
Yeah.
So it has whatever they're using doesn't attack the styrofoam.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
And I know that if you used plastic wood, it would attack the styrofoam.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that's inert to the styrofoam
right.
that they're using. But it's a very ingenious way of getting a hard model.
But as you say, the adjustments are almost impossible.
Well, you can always butter up with that. You can cut away and you've got a hard model like that.
Mm-hmm.
You're better off with an applewood model than you are with a styrofoam model,
right.
I think. Because you've got something solid there to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, once you've got the applewood, you could always go to Bondo
mm-hmm.
or anything else.
Right.
You could clay up on it, and cast off and apply a piece to a model
mm-hmm.
if that were necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was wood used in Europe. But basically plaster, and then I think since the war, this applewood and clay, basically used for ornamentation
mm-hmm.
and such things as grill frames and maybe headlight bezels, things that you would have the freedom of expression on. The stylist didn't have much freedom. bodies were designed by a designer as a as an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And once designed on the board, they didn't get much change. They would build up a full-size mock-up and do some minor things, you know, unless they didn't like the whole thing and throw the whole thing out. But they start again, they would go back to the board. Of course, Ford, since Ford had clay models over here and did clay model development, it was proper that they would do the same thing over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I had mentioned earlier, we had developed the Ford 12M, 15M vehicle here, and that was, I think, in, maybe 50, 51, I'm not sure. And it came into production maybe in 54. And that had been done in clay, and cast had been made off of it and shipped to Germany. So they were familiar with the system.
Mm-hmm.
So when they wanted to do their 17M, they came over, and they did the 17M. Well, I didn't work on that project, and I had mentioned that that was sort of a scaled-down version of the, I guess it was the 53 Ford. Could have been 53 or 55, 55 of the Ford that had the leaning headlights. And it was a terrible design, just awful. And this that ran in Germany for, oh, well, it ran until the new car came out, which was in 61. I guess fall of 64, 61.
Stopgap.
Yeah, well, we did a facelift on it over there, which helped it a little bit, but we didn't. We weren't able to do anything for the for those front fender headlights. They were just anti-aerodynamic, you know. They were air catchers.
Mm.
And the cars in Germany, it was the wrong thing. But this was a Gilspear design.
Oh, really?
He had led that development. And I was really happy I didn't work on it, because I couldn't have. Anyway, Andrews came on board.
What was his first name again?
John Andrews. Mm-hmm. In early, and I suppose in January of 1958. He had been with General Motors. He'd been with General Motors before the war, and had been in Germany with Opel. And was able to escape Germany, he and his wife, and a truckload of his furniture and all of his belongings, just hours before war was declared with the United States. And got over the border into, I guess, Belgium, and eventually back here, of course. He was in South America then, with General Motors. And while in South America, well, he was in the war, of course. And I think he was he was in the Navy and was a Navy commander or captain or something, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war, he went back to General Motors, and General Motors sent him to South America, Argentina, someplace. And while he was there, he had a tragedy. They had two children, two boys. The older boy was with him, and they were in an automobile accident, and the older boy was killed. John Andrews was a very, well, very, you no doubt have met the type, Henry Ford II. A few of these people, you know, that distinguished themselves as business leaders, and he was very astute business head, and was able to think things through and get everything organized in his mind and come to a meeting and, you know, control the thing and get things done the way he wanted. His older son, the one that was killed, had taken after him, was very similar, very smart kid, and so this was, you know, a real tragedy to him. His wife, well, they had a younger boy. His wife was a very nice person, not a social type person, you know. He was more of a lean more on the socialite type of person than she did. She went along with him, of course, and was you know, his sidekick. Their other son took more like her. He was easygoing and not the business head. Well, when that happened, I guess they were brought back from South America, and somehow he had this opportunity to come to Ford, and which he did, and he was given this assignment, since he had spent years Ford of Germany before the war. Well, it was a natural thing to, since Ford wanted to send someone from here over there to really run it. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a natural to send John Andrews over there. And so that's how John Andrews got there. Well, so he wanted to do a new car. And so he would come in and talk about that with Wes Dahlberg in our studio before the studio was broken up.
Mm-hmm.
And saw what we were doing and some of the developments that we had done there. We had made, I think, this one model, which I had maybe mentioned. It was done as an advance model, study. And of course, he saw this, and it was quite fresh. And so this seemed to be a logical start point for a new design.